So I wanted to, this is slides I was finishing this morning. I wanted to add a few words about tactile interaction, gestural interaction, and instrumental interaction, which I will talk about some more later, to sort of show what are the potential and limitations of these techniques, because gesture and touch have become, over the past few years, a really big part of the way we interact with computers. And this was not supposed to be here. Yeah, here we are. Sorry. So, tactile and gestural interaction. So, first of all, I wanted to try to define this a bit better, because people talk about touch, about gesture, and now that we have seen a little bit of the psychological aspects behind this, we can maybe be a bit more precise. So what I call tactile interaction is interaction that involves a sense of touch. And as you remember from last time, the sense of touch is a composite sense that combines the sense of touch itself with the six types of sensors that we talked about. The ones we're more concerned with are pressure and fine and touch and coarse touch, but essentially pressure and even a limited form of pressure called the contact. The sense of touch, we saw it was also proprioception, is the idea that you know the configuration of your own body in space, which allows you to touch your nose with your eyes closed. And there is the kinesthesis, which is the sense of tension of the muscles, which lets you assess the weight of an object, for example. And so, as I said before, the result is that what we call a touch interface or tactile interface is not a touch interface. Because of all the capabilities of touch, it's using one, which is the sense of contact, which is linked to the sense of pressure. But in fact, most of these interfaces do not sense pressure. They just sense, are you touching or not touching? So if we were to create real tactile interfaces, we would have to leverage other aspects of the sense of touch. And that would require new hardware. So there are starting to be touch surfaces that sense pressure, although they do this in a way that is not very precise yet. If you look at the, well, not the latest anymore, but the latest iPhone introduced Force Touch, and essentially they're putting four sensors at the four corners of the phone, so that when you touch, it knows where you're touching, and by triangulating from these four sensors, it can infer how much you're pressing. But if you're putting multiple touches down, it's not as precise. So, and then what about the ability to sense the shape? What about the kinesthetic aspect? What about the ability to sense surface? There are some prototypes that create a sense of texture, for example, but they only work over the entire surface. And they can do this either through piezoelectric by vibrating the surface. They can also do this through electric field. But wherever you touch on the surface, you will have the same sensation. So it's not quite there yet, but what we call tactile interface or touch interface are still extremely poor compared to the sense of touch. I said that before, but I'll say it again. Now, something I haven't talked about as much before is about gestural interfaces. Because, of course, when you touch, you use also your motor system and you produce gestures. So I actually looked up in the dictionary and what's defined as A gesture is a movement that illustrates or replaces a word or sentence. And so in HCI, when we use the word gesture, when I do a pinch, it's considered a gesture. Now, is that a movement that illustrates or replaces a word or sentence? Well, I can describe what I want to do with a pinch, which is to make a picture bigger or smaller, but I can describe anything with words. So I don't think it's the same thing to using a pinch gesture to enlarge a picture versus using a double tap, for example, or using the kind of gestures you see on the right, which have meaning because we have decided that they have a certain meaning. So if I do this in French, what does it mean? Money. Yeah. In other countries, too, I guess. But this is a code, whereas if I show someone a pinch and the effect of a pinch, this is one trial learning. People will understand what it means because it relates to a physical manipulation. So it's important to better understand the aspects, the features of not just touch, but what Claude Cadot called the gestural channel. The communication abilities that we have and the information gathering activities, capabilities we have through gestures. And Claude Cadot has identified three characteristics, I think are really important. One is the epistemic function. We use gestures to acquire information about our environment. By touching this sheet of paper, a blind person will be able to read letters, but you and I will be able to feel the bumps and the holes. By sensing this piece of rock, I will be able to figure out its shape, its texture, and things like this. So this is the epistemic function, is to acquire information. And on current touch interfaces, there's none of this. Because to acquire information, a flat piece of glass doesn't tell me anything. The second function of the gestural channel is what he calls the ergodic function. It's the ability through gestures and movement to transform objects in the environment. So we see here someone shaping a pottery. This is another form of action, a bit more violent. But we use our hands in particular and our bodies to shape objects. Again, current interfaces, you know, it's not recommended to try to fold or twist your phone. But there's a lot of interest in the research community to make bendable devices with sensors that would sense how you're bending them or folding them and interpret them. So it's not impossible, and I think with advances in material science and all that, it will become a possibility. And think of the kind of things you could do if, instead of having, you know, a flat and fairly solid slab of glass and metal in your hand, you had something that you could shape, fold in half, or stretch, or other things. And the third function of the gestural channel is called the semiotic function, and it's to communicate information. And that's the one that uses this language that is coded, that, you know, in many countries, if I do this, it means I'm, well, if I do this in the room, it's going to look weird. Maybe I say, yeah, you guys are good. But if I'm, you know, standing on the side of the road, it means I'm hitchhiking. Another example is a conductor has a coded language to communicate with musicians to synchronize their play, but also to communicate emotion. I think it's really important to see that there are the three functions because they're often combined, and so we don't spontaneously identify them as separate things. And so, by the way, for a semiotic function, in current interfaces, we use a lot of semiotic function of gestures when we create gesture shortcuts. When you you're asked to enter a particular gesture to unlock your phone, or
some, I know Android has the ability to have gestures that you define to have shortcuts to go to a particular app or do a particular thing. But even things like double tap and long tap, in general, you know, they're not, they're conventional in the sense that it's a convention that we've decided that they do a particular thing. So, as I said, these three functions are often intertwined. And if I take the example here of an expert cello player, there is the epistemic function of acquiring information as he touches the screen and what's it called?
The neck,
thank you, of the instrument. He acquires information to place his fingers in the right position. There's the ergodic function, which is by moving the bow, he is transmitting energy, in fact, to the strings, and that's what makes the instrument make music in a very physical, literal way. But again, this involves an epistemic function because he probably gets feedback about how the strings are vibrating through the fingers that are on the neck. And actually through the bow as well. And finally, there's a semiotic function that, you know, through his music, he's communicating emotion to the audience, and they will probably react to the way they react and behave. So these things are extremely subtle, intertwined, and we're used to combine all of this in our everyday life. And again, I want to point out that current interfaces are pretty bad at doing most of this. And typically, they use what I've called pseudo-ergodic gestures. So on the right, which was an old ad for the Kinect, I guess, where, you know, it's supposed to play football, where you can kick the virtual ball. It's not the same as kicking the real ball. And the system is capturing through the sensor, trying to get, you know, the amount of energy you and the direction and all that, but it's really not the same thing. Like, you can hurt yourself if you try to do real kick, and, you know, soccer players know that if you miss the ball, it's much worse than if you hit it. But it's also the same thing of the pinch gestures. It's, you know, the system gives you the illusion, and with pinch it works pretty well, but it's not a real ergodic gestures. I'm not manipulating a material. I'm faking it, in a sense. It's not necessarily bad, but it's important to understand that there are differences, and our manual abilities are much more fine than what current systems use today. So the second aspect is that the gesture vocabulary you use is very limited. In most interfaces, it's touch is used essentially for either entering literal input, like drawing, we talked about this, or navigating. When it comes to more complex tasks like authoring things and creating content, it's a lot more limited because in the real world, to do this more complex task, we use a bunch of tools. And these systems are not really based on the notion of tool, and I will talk about this in a minute. And the other thing is the in this kind of situations, also here, it's more imitation gesture. You make it as if it were playing football when, in fact, it's not. So there's a lot of limits of gesture interfaces. Some that are often ignored because it's more convenient to ignore them, but fatigue. Interacting, we do a lot of work, as I said, on wall-size display. But it's tiring to be standing and to gesture with your hand. And when you get tired, you are less precise. And then there is the key problem of how you discover the vocabulary, the gestures that the system recognizes and interprets. And that's been a big problem because a lot of the way we use gestures to interact are based on the semiotic function, so you need to know the code. You need to know which gestures are there, which gestures do what. The system oftentimes does not have the right affordances to help you discover this. So here's an example of a system that could help with this. It's called Octopocus. It was done by Olivier Beau and Wendy Mackay a few years ago. And the idea here is that you are on a tablet with a pen that could be with its finger as well, although occlusion can be a problem. And the system recognizes a certain number of traces. So you could write a question mark to get help. You could write an S for save, maybe some other gesture for another function. And it's hard to remember these gestures. And so the system, in fact, lets you, gives you information if you hesitate. And there's a key idea here is that if you know what you're doing, you're going to do it. And if you don't know what you want to do, or how to do it, rather, you would pause. So here, if I put my pen down and I start drawing a question mark, the system let me do it and will interpret my question mark. But if I don't know, I will put the pen down and wait. And when I wait, the system will display the beginning of the various marks I can make, go here to do a help, go here to do a quit, etc. And as I go, you will see that some marks disappear because the beginning of my gesture makes the other gestures much less likely. Right? So we call this progressive feedforward and feedback. So in novice mode, you'll see the help and you'll progress. In expert mode, you draw the gesture. In intermediate mode, you can pause halfway through and we'll show you the possible continuation there. And then recognition is mapped to the thickness. So here I'm going to go to save, and you see that two have already disappeared, two are thinning down, and then they completely disappear because once you've started to do an S, it's not going to be a question mark anymore. And that gives you both feedback, but it also helps you to learn how to do the right gesture. So in a sense, the computer is helping you, but it's also so that you help the computer in the future by doing the proper mark. That's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to get back here. Okay, and so that leads me to this notion of instrumental interaction. Because I think a lot of the limitations of today's touch interfaces, but also mouse-based interfaces, is that they try to be direct. They try to have you touch things on the screen and act with your bare hands with everything. But humans have developed many tools for interacting with the environment. In the 18th century, Diderot d'Alembert created the entire encyclopedia with listing all the tools that were being used for all types of jobs and works in France and Europe. These are tools that were used by wood workers. And just look around. I mean, you have pens, you have a number of, you know, wear glasses, you may ride a bike. So a lot of interaction is not directly with the objects of interest, to use Schindlerman's description, but is through tools. We use a pen to write. We use, you know, a bunch of sophisticated instruments for cooking, pans and sticks and forks and knives. Woodworking, but also things like a bicycle to move. And so we've created these tools to adapt the environment to our capabilities and to be able to do things that we would not be able to do bare hand. So, you know, try to drive a nail without a hammer, it's going to be difficult. It's going to hurt, I'll tell you. So there is this kind of contradiction between Schneiderman saying it has to be direct manipulation. But he meant direct manipulation in the sense that we were manipulating objects that had sort of the appearance of a physicality
By contrast, with the interfaces before, which were based on naming everything, naming the commands, naming the files, naming the objects, naming the parameters. Because in reality, our interaction is mediated. I use a pen to write on a piece of paper. If I didn't have a pen, well, we probably didn't have paper, right? How would you write if you didn't have a pen, a pencil, a brush, or anything? Well, you can use your finger to draw things in the sand. But you need to have sand for doing this. It's not very practical. So we've developed a lot of this technology to mediate our interaction with the environment. And I will, well, the thing I want to say today is that tools are extremely powerful because we internalize the tool as an extension of our body. Now, I'm talking of a tool here that you hold in your hand, or something like a bike that for, with which you have direct physical interaction. And so when you have a tool in your hand, you change the affordances of the environment. Once I put a pencil, a brush, a chalk in the hands of a kid, a number of surfaces become writable, like the walls of his room. And there's even evidence from cognitive science that it modifies what is called the body schema, which is your perception of your body and your body capabilities, so beyond the proprioception. And for example, we have neurons in our head that fire when we perceive an object as being reachable. So if I'm standing here, I know I can reach that object with my hand, and I don't have to try to figure out if it works or not. I'm pretty good at estimating this, but I know I cannot reach that. I would have to bend over. And there are neurons that actually make this distinction. Now, if you give me a stick, and that object becomes reachable with a stick, those neurons will fire as soon as I have the stick in my hand. And so I think this is a very powerful feature of human cognition that can be leveraged in user interfaces. And in fact, a number of systems actually already do this more or less explicitly. So this is an interface on the iPad called Paper, which is pretty cool. So it's a sort of conventional drawing tool. It has several several pencils and markers and things for drawing. It has this thing where you can mix colors. So you can pick several colors here and then mix them, like you would do with a brush, I guess, on the painter's palette. It has multiple notebooks, and you can actually use pinch to close and open a notebook, and you can use a third finger to pull a page out. So there's this kind of very physical manipulation. But the manipulation here is with the tools, and you've seen other examples, maybe, like in iPhoto, to show the various visual effects that you can make on your photo. It shows you these palettes here. It's a little bit like the side views, in fact, we were looking at before. But it's using a metaphor of this samples of color that graphic designers are used to using. And so it gives you this notion of physical interaction with tools that are intermediates between you and the object. I took another example here. When the Wiimote came out, it's this controller that you hold in your hand, and it has accelerometers, so you can sense the movement. And there started to be an entire industry of selling add-ons for these Wiimote controllers to make it look like a golf club, like a tennis racket, like a steering wheel, to make your interaction more physical and make you do the right gestures, the right movements that the system was then, or the game was then, interpreting. But again, they are very limited. And that's the thing that bugs me, because I think we can do a lot better. So, you know, in the paper interface here, I have wonderful tools for drawing. But they only work in the paper application. And if I'm in iPhoto here, and I want to write a note on the photo before I send it to a friend or a relative, well, I can't use the pen that is in the paper app. But in the physical world, when you... Has anybody a notebook here? Too many computers. When you wrote this note, when you bought this notebook, it didn't come with a pen that you had to use, and it was the only pen you could use with that notebook, right? So why is it that something that is so obvious and simple in the physical world becomes impossible in the digital world? I mean, it's not the problem of you know, being an intractable problem. It's not breaking. It's not beyond what a Turing machine could do.
It's application dependent.
It's application dependent. Yeah. Why?
You can just make it like global, like having these tools that we use to use. We put them in the desktop, for example, and we can reuse them in different applications.
But we can't. And I don't see why.
Well, I don't see why not. And I think it's because we have been trained to this notion of application, that an application is bound to a particular type of content, it's bound to a particular type of tools, you buy the whole package, and it's closed. The Xerox Star did not have applications. The document could contain text, it could contain drawing, it could contain other things. The system was not open to outside developers, so I don't know how they would extend this. But from the end user, there was no notion of an application. And I think when you start thinking of interactions through tools, and the fact that tools can be used in different contexts and sometimes appropriated for things that were not necessarily designed for, you can start thinking about designing interfaces in a different way and breaking this model of the application. In the interest of time, I really don't know why the things that I had hidden in this presentation are still showing up. I want to show a couple of...
So what I will do is next time I will talk more about instrumental interaction in terms of applying that to the digital world and what it could mean and ways to do this. What I wanted to do today, while we wait for Mehdi to come and present you the Internet of Things. He is here. Come in, Mehdi.
Hello.
But let me just show you a couple of videos just to finish on a lighter note. This you have seen. This you have not. This is called SkinPut. You can see it, so you'll have to see the video. So SkinPut is a system where you wear a projector on your shoulder, and it can project images on your arm and hand. And through a sensor that you wear on your arm, it can tell where you are typing on your hand or in your arm. And so you can have interaction with your own body that doesn't require to have, you know, a tablet with you. You are the tablet. And the example we saw here is he has this phone thing and he's dialing a phone number directly on his hand. So this is Chris Harrison, SkinPut. Chris has done a bunch of very interesting and innovative things. I wanted to talk a little bit, mention interactive paper. I mentioned it. This is work that we have done in the group, where we have a sheet of paper with this pattern printed on it. And it's linked to a music synthesizer. So these are tonettes. It's a way to represent a set of notes. And so this pen draws on the paper, but also records all the movements you do, so that then you can tap the trace you just left, and the system will recognize that you want to replay the same sequence, but in the other interface, part of the interface, you can place them as chords instead of in sequence. I think it's only this one. And so the fact that you have the physicality of papers, which musicians are really used to, the fact that you leave those traces but it stays interactive is an interesting mix between physical and digital world.
Using Macrominder Vector as a prototyping tool and working on the active desk, we envisioned how bricks can be attached to virtual objects.
One of the first work
the bricks
of
can
tangible
be reused
interaction,
and recycled.
Where they're using these wooden blocks that are tracked by the system to manipulate.
When you have two bricks attached to the same virtual object, you can perform actions such as stretching the object. Or since we are sensing both position and orientation information, we can deform the virtual object.
And the idea is that you have two hands, but there could be three people, and you could have six hands, and so you have this multiple hand interaction that is fairly natural. You don't see any interface there. The blocks you use and how you use them determines the functions that you can apply. So I don't have a video, but you should look online the stuff on the React table, which in fact is a modern version of this for music. V. Kruger, we saw before this one as well. And I want to finish, and I guess it will be a transition with your presentation, that there are more and more sensors that are coming out to capture in particular gestures. So there's the lip motion, which has a stupid music. What did this come up on the side? I don't know. What did I do? Sorry. So the lip motion is this little device here that captures the position of your hands in a fairly short, small space, but very accurate. And so you can do all sorts of gesture-based interaction with this. Although it does have the limitation that I talked about before, which is you're still doing freehand gestures and you don't feel the things, but maybe could tell you a lot about haptics to make this more realistic. There is the MIO, which is a system that senses your muscle activity. So you can detect gestures that you do with the hands with just a sensor on your forearm here. So you don't need an external sensor like a Kinect. So here is their demo video that was controlling sound. They all make such a good music. Or you're piloting a drone just with a power. So, you know, of course, it's with you. I'll show that another time. The one I wanted to finish with is not this one. This is Room Alive. This is a recent work by Microsoft where they use both a connection of Kinects to capture the geometry of the room, what furniture is in the room, as well as where the users are, and a bunch of projectors to project on the furniture and on the wall. And so they can actually augment your environment, and here it's in the context
of a prototype that transforms any room into
a game where the monsters appears on your wall, on your table, but the system knows the geometry of the room, so can adapt the game to your particular living room and literally augment it. And I think it's a pretty cool system. And they had done a lighter version before that was projecting and things on the furniture around your TV screen when you're playing a game on the TV screen to augment effects, like when there's a blast, your whole thing's like shaked and things like this. So it's just an example of better mix between the physical world and the digital world. So I will stop here. And if you have any question. No? Okay, so...